This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ted Koppel, sitting in for Neil Cornyn. And we have an overly enthusiastic audience that jumped in long before they were supposed to. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum in Washington, D.C., and we're going to be talking about China. Sure, the price of a gallon of gas has shot up and up and up, and Americans are not happy. In fact, Americans are getting unhappier by the day. But not too long from now, say a decade or two, we may look back at 2008 with something approaching nostalgia. It's not just the price of gasoline that may look downright cheap. 2008 may go down as one of the last years when America was still able to fuel its car-crazed culture. What happens when the world's most populous country, China, 1.3 billion strong, begins to demand some of the gasoline and oil we've been taking for granted for so long? Well, they've already begun demanding it. And that day, indeed, is not only not far off, it is well underway. Consider this. China is putting 25,000 new cars on the road every day. And to help you do the math, that's about 9 million new cars a year. Already, the Chinese demand for oil is 8 times what it is in the West. In 15 years or so, China will have as many cars on its highway system as America does. So the question that we begin with is, what happens when 300 or 400 or even 500 million Chinese are driving cars and not riding bikes? Where does all of that energy come from? And the ultimate question, what happens when the world's energy supply simply can't keep up with the demand? How can we prepare for what could be a coming collision with China? Our telephone number here at Talk of the Nation is 800-989-8255. Our email address, in case you want to send us an email, is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And later, we'll be talking with our political junkie, Ken Rudin, but we begin with Nicholas Lardy, who is senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, and he joins me here at the Newseum. But Nick, if you'll forgive me, first of all, to get a shameless plug out of the way, my colleagues at the Discovery Channel and I, many of those colleagues here in the audience at the Newseum this afternoon, have spent the better part of the last year reporting from the western Chinese city of Chongqing, fast becoming China's Detroit, for a 4-part series that kicks off this evening at 10 on the Discovery Channel, and then at 10 tomorrow, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And if you have time, we'd love you to watch. Nick, I handed over to you just before we went on the air an item that made a little bit of news yesterday, and let me just read you the headline here. China's economy to become the world's biggest in 2035. Now, this is a study with which you're familiar by Albert Keidel of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he says China's economy will overtake that of the United States by 2035. And then he goes on to say it'll be twice its size by 2050. What do you think?
Well, I don't think, given China's growth trajectory and underlying factors, they have the capacity to grow very, very rapidly for another couple of decades, and that clearly probably will put them in the position of being the largest economy sometime around 2030, maybe 2035, as the study suggests. At that time, however, China will still be, in per capita terms, very substantially behind the United States. In other words, they will, in the aggregate, be as big as the U.S., but in per capita terms, they won't be enjoying the same lifestyle that we have in the U.S. And there are, of course, risks to the projection. They could stumble. There could be political discontinuity that could throw them off the growth track they're on. I think they have the potential to achieve it. Whether or not they'll actually achieve it, I think, is an open question.
What you're saying, I think, Nick, is that they may still, indeed, they almost certainly will have far more poor people than we do. Maybe their standard of living across the board will not be as good as ours is. But when we come to those questions that I was positing before, the fact that they and we are going to be on a collision course for some of the world's major energy sources, that seems unavoidable, doesn't it?
Indeed, and as you already suggested, I think it's underway. It's well underway. If you look at the last 5 years, China has been a bigger source of incremental demand than the United States has been. Indeed, China accounted over the last 5 years for about a third of all the increase in oil consumption on the globe. And that's a function of the fact that they're growing much more rapidly than anyone else, that they're starting to move into the automotive age. So transportation is taking a growing share of their energy needs.
Now, I should reveal to our listening audience that that four-part series I spoke about that begins on Discovery tonight, Nick Lardy was an enormous help to us on that and gave us a lot of advice on what to do and what not to do and where to go. One of the things we discovered, Nick, that I know you have known for a very long time, is that in addition to becoming a car culture, it is now China is becoming a highway culture. 33,000 miles of superhighways in China already, and expanding not only within the country, but also into neighboring countries of Southeast Asia. And when you think of China of 30 or 40 years ago, where a worker might have had to go to his labor unit and get a work pass just to go from town A to town B, the way that this is going to change China is staggering. Now, would you just sort of vent on that issue a little bit?
Well, I certainly agree. And its mobility and its the ability not just to move around but to change jobs, choose where you want to live, all those things were very highly constrained on the eve of economic reform 25 or 30 years ago. People rarely moved out of the place they were born. Indeed, many people never even saw anything beyond where they were born. And now there's a great deal of mobility within China, and it is transforming the society and particularly the economy. And might also add, it's possible that this is happening on such an accelerated pace, primarily because the government is building the infrastructure almost in advance of demand. They have built this 33,000 miles in a relatively short period of time. At the beginning of reform, they didn't have any highways would be up to the standard of what we would call an interstate or divided highway or anything like that. And they have built this system at a relatively short time period, and it's still expanding as we speak.
Many people don't remember, or at least the older members of our audience will, that back in the 1950s, President Eisenhower did essentially the same thing here in the United States, created an interstate highway system and much of what we take for granted in America today, our suburbs, our shopping centers, our office parks, that are all based on an automobile, a ubiquitous automobile economy, changed the very nature of the country in which we live. What's it going to do in China?
Well, it's certainly going to change. It is already changing China, as we've suggested, but whether or not they'll be able to follow the same path, I think, is highly uncertain. A great deal will depend on what the ultimate price of petroleum turns out to be. Are we moving to permanently much, much higher prices, or are we just at a spike at this point? We did all that in a period of very cheap oil and very cheap gasoline, and we're already discovering in the United States that adjusting to $4 gas is somewhat painful, as your opening remarks suggested. And so China's move towards an automobile culture may be less rapid than ours was in the 40s and 50s, for example, because the price may inhibit the development of patterns of settlement, for example, that follow the spread of population the way we have done in the United States.
As I pointed out before, Nick, we are before a live audience here at the museum, and Libby is at one of our microphones. We're going to bring the audience in. And we also want to bring you at home in. If you want to call, you can reach us at 1-800-989-8255. Libby, what's your question?
Does this study include the possibility of a change in China's government?
In other words, if the economy grows as rapidly as that study suggests, you're asking, is that likely to do away with the communist government?
Yes.
I'm putting words in your mouth. You mind?
No.
All right. Nick?
The study does not really deal with a change in the political system. I think Dr. Keidel's presumption is over this period we're likely to have a one-party state, although he thinks that party is transforming itself and has moved away from the kind of a highly authoritarian model of the past to a somewhat more political system. But if you just look at the formal structure, he's not expecting so much change.
You know, something interesting happened right after the earthquake a few weeks ago in Chengdu. There were people from automobile clubs in Chongqing, which is only a few hundred miles away, who loaded up their SUVs with supplies, with medicine, with clothing, with food, and they drove to Chengdu to help the victims of the earthquake. The government let that go for a couple of weeks, and then it shut it down. Why?
I don't know. I think you'd have to be on the ground in Chengdu to be sure. There was a lot of outpouring of support for the people that were affected by the earthquake, donations coming in from all over the country, not just from nearby cities like Chengdu, like Chongqing, but from far, far away, way in the eastern part of China, several thousand kilometers away rather than a couple hundred miles.
But if I suggested to you, Nick, that the Chinese government, the communist government, is a little bit scared of voluntarism, a little bit scared of people doing things on their own without direction, would you accept that?
I certainly would. They don't like self-organized things. They want to be in control or have oversight. And I would say, however, that they allowed more voluntarism in this event than we've ever seen in the last decades in China.
A little bit off the subject, but very quickly, Nick, before we take a break, are the Olympics going to change anything, do you think?
I don't think they'll have a big effect economically. Politically, there may be some fallout after. Many people think there will be the government will clamp back down again in certain respects. So there could be some change on the political front, but I think not so much on the economic side.
I'm talking with Nicholas Lardy, the subject, the looming economic cloud of China. I'm Ted Koppel. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Ted Koppel at the Knight Studio in the Newseum. And as you can tell, we have a very tame and well-trained audience here who applauds on cue. Our topic, why Americans need to pay attention to China, our guest, Nicholas Lardy, who is senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. We'll be going to your calls in just a moment, but we have another question from Carol, who is at a microphone here in the museum. Carol, go ahead.
Hi, I'm wondering if China is taking steps to avoid the mistakes the United States has made with a heavy investment in a car-oriented infrastructure to the expense of mass transit, bicycle lanes, and other more environmentally friendly and sustainable methods of transportation.
Before I go to Nick for the larger answer, a national answer, the city of Chongqing, which is a huge city, about 12.5 million people right now. One thing you do notice is the buses and the taxi cabs are running on liquid natural gas right now. The government has determined that that should be so. So they are clearly taking some steps. But nationally, Nick, are they preparing?
I would say they're doing both. They're certainly promoting the automobile industry, but to give you an example on mass transit, currently China is, in different cities in China, are building 75 different subway lines. Now, some big cities like Beijing and Shanghai have more than one line under construction, but by the time they're finished, they're going to have significant subway systems in quite a number of their major cities. They're going to have much more capacity in subways, for example, than we do in the United States. As far as I'm aware, there's not a single city in the United States that's building a new subway system or building a new a whole new line. So I think they're moving on the mass transit. LNG is very pervasive, particularly even in Beijing. And they're making substantial investments in facilities to offload liquefied natural gas in ports, and particularly in South China. They're making major commitments to buy LNG long-term in the global market, and they recognize that it's a much cleaner form of energy. So they're trying to have it both ways, basically, at the moment. They are doing a lot on mass transit, but the private automobile is certainly on the rise in China.
We have a phone call from Jason in Bend, Oregon. Jason, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes, you can hear me. Now, Jason, your question, please.
Yes, well, I don't have a question more than I have just a comment. You know, I believe that China's been, we've known that China's going to be a superpower for quite a while, and that's why I believe that that's why we're over in the Middle East now, to secure the oil and the natural gas there to supply China. I think we've been preparing for this for a long time. If you Google the Project for a New American Century, which is a think tank that was brought together in the late 90s to deal with these upcoming problems, and they outlined what exactly we would need to do to be able to withstand this China being a major superpower that they're going to be.
So your theory, Jason, is that one of the reasons we went into Iraq was to secure enough oil over there so that we could not only supply ourselves but supply the Chinese.
That's correct. I mean, it's, everybody's known for years that that the oil supplies in the world are dwindling, and
okay.
You know that's where all the oil and natural gas is in the Middle East.
Let's talk to our expert, Nick Lardy. What do you think, Nick?
Well, I'm of the belief that the world oil market, even though it has some strong participants, that it's basically a very market-determined environment, and the countries that can afford to pay for the oil will be the ones that, in the end, are able to import it. I think that we certainly see that in the case of China. They now depend on imports for about as much of their oil as does the United States, but they're a big exporting country, so they have the earnings to be able to pay for the imports. And I think the Middle Eastern countries, as well as other oil suppliers, are going to have to sell into the international market. So I'm quite frankly skeptical that our military activities in the Middle East are motivated by oil.
Even if they were, Nick, is there enough oil in the Persian Gulf? I mean, is there enough oil in Iraq to be able to meet even our needs, let alone the Chinese needs? Forget about the Indians and the rest of the world.
No.
Well, that's quick enough. All right. Roberta here, you're... yes,
hi.
There you are. You have a question?
Thank you for this wonderful program.
Thank you.
As China expands, many Chinese will be left behind in rural areas and in poverty. When I've been to China, I've experienced that level of inequality. Will China's political system be able to control the possible explosions of discontent that might follow as more and more enjoy the riches?
Let me just add one point, Nick. According to the Chinese government's own figures, in 2006 they had something like 87,000 demonstrations. I mean, there are a lot of people out in the countryside who are very unhappy, as that question suggests. But what's your larger answer?
Well, if you look at the data and look at what's actually happened in China, if you take a longer term perspective over the last 30 years, and I think this is pointed out in the program that will start airing this evening on Discovery, and that is hundreds.
Well done, Nick.
Mr. Koppel has sent me some DVDs in advance. I've already seen them. I know what's in all the segments, but hundreds of millions of people have escaped poverty in China over the last 30 years, and the number remaining, of course, is still very large, and you could argue about what the standard should be, and even those that have escape the official poverty level are living at levels that are very difficult, I think, for people who live in North America to really understand. But I do think they've made substantial progress. This has been a growth pattern that virtually everybody has benefited from. Inequality is increasing. That's why we have the rise of a car culture. There are a few people that have enough money to buy cars now, and they're growing. But even people at the bottom of the income distribution, the poorest people, have seen their lives improve dramatically over the last 30 years. Most of the rural discontent is not so much over low income or poverty as case corruption, quite frankly. Local government officials are taking the land and converting it for projects that line their pockets, and the local peasantry loses out. So it's more, I think, the most of the rural unrest is a result of what I would call abuse of power by local party officials rather than people who are protesting their low incomes.
We've got a caller, Steve, in Akron, Ohio. Go ahead, please.
Hello? Hi. I think a lot of the problem is the oil companies are pretty much controlling this administration. The Bush family, other members of his administration are all part of the oil company heritage. They want to keep the price high. They want to fuel this fear that we're going to run out of oil. They're not pushing for any new technologies to come out of the market soon. Congress passes legislation to give us 35 miles per gallon by the year 2020, when that could probably take place in the next 5 years if everybody put their minds to it. If we can send a man to the moon and do that in 10 years, we should certainly be able to come up with a car that can get over 100 miles to the gallon in 12 years. Plus, the new technologies for hydrogen, solar, and electric should be on the market by then, so this demand should be much lower if we have administrations that are willing to cooperate with what the people's needs are rather than what the corporation's profits should be.
Steve, I have a feeling there's never going to be a question at the end of this, so I'm just going to let Nick respond to your comment. Go ahead.
Well, certainly there are potential in alternative sources of energy, but I think the most important factor is the price. And as the price of oil goes up and up and up, then the new technologies are going to come on faster. And I don't think the oil companies that may want to have higher profits from higher oil prices are going to really be able to stop the development of new technologies. We have the entrepreneurship, and once the economic incentives are right, I think we'll see, as they are rapidly becoming, I think we'll see an accelerated pace of commercial adoption of alternative energy sources.
And the fact of the matter is, although we're drifting a little bit away from our subject, a lot of these alternate energy businesses are owned by the oil companies themselves. So it's a win-win proposition for many of them. All right, we have another phone call in Chicago. That would be Bill. Can you hear me, Bill?
Yes, I can. Thank you both for taking my call. My question had to do with the increase in commodities almost across the board, partly because of Chinese demand, specifically things like copper and steel. My question is, and it kind of dovetails into the last caller, with respect to alternative energy, are we going to wind up in not a bidding war over oil, but eventually a bidding war over the commodities we need to make wind turbines, to make some of the other infrastructure required for alternative energy? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you much.
China, Nick, is now, what, biggest producer and consumer of steel? Is that right?
Yes, by a substantial margin. China has certainly driven up commodity prices, whether you're talking about iron ore, nickel, just across the board. They have been probably the single most important factor over the last few years driving up commodity prices because of their very high growth and their very high capital intensity of growth. But I don't think that's going to prevent the emergence of alternative energy sources over time. We're still going to be able to produce enough of whatever it is, the blades that go into the wind turbines and so forth, in order to make wind a more important source of energy.
You know, there's a larger question, Nick, that I posed a little bit earlier, and I don't think either you or I properly addressed it. Let me throw it back at you again. We clearly are in competition with the Chinese. That competition is only going to become more intense. There is not a limitless supply of all of these commodities or of oil or of natural gas. How does that get resolved?
Well, I think the market is going to be a major factor as demand rises or continues to rise for these commodities. People that can pay for it are going to get it. And I don't, you know, people say that the Chinese are going around making investments in the Sudan and so forth, and they're trying to lock up energy supplies, and they're going to hold it off the market, and so that it will adversely affect the United States and other Western countries. I think that's a little bit of a misunderstanding of the way these markets work, because the real driver of demand in China is the growth of their economy. And they may buy the oil they need on the spot market, or they may invest in the Sudan and other places. But if their economy is growing rapidly, that's the ultimate source of demand, and that's what's going to drive the price. So I think it will be mediated through a market rather than through state power.
All right, Sam here at the museum, you've got a question?
Yes, Sam Martino from Whitewater, Wisconsin. My question is, Buick has had a large presence in China, and with the Chinese auto boom, what's the future of American manufacturing of an American car there?
Great question, for which I actually have a legitimate response. Do you know that more Buicks are sold in China right now than in the United States?
Yes, I do.
Happens to be true only of Buick. But what about the larger question of the fact that we now have huge Ford plants in China, General Motors plants, Chrysler plants? That's not terrific news for the United Auto Workers. It's not great news in Michigan. But on balance, is it good news for American companies? Is it good news for the American economy?
I think on balance, it is good news for the American economy. I think if you look at the U.S. auto industry, it has not been very successful in selling cars anywhere in the world produced in North America. And I don't think they would have been successful trying to export from North America to China. So the way they can participate in that market is the way that Ted has just outlined. That is, they've built manufacturing facilities in China itself, and they've gotten a pretty decent share of the car market. It's contributing to the bottom line of the companies. So I think at least so far, it's been a very positive development for the auto companies and for the industry more generally.
Nick, we have to let people know who we are and what they're listening to. You're actually listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we have another question here, this time from Dee.
Yeah, hello. Does communism actually affect that much of China right now?
Well, Nick?
Well, I would say definitely yes. This is captured in the title of the program that starts this evening, The People's Republic of Capitalism. The People's Republic, I think, refers to the fact that all countries that start out with the name People's Republic are single-party states, and they tend to be on the authoritarian side. But it's the People's Republic of Capitalism because they have a market economy with a lot of competition. But certainly the party is in control of the major parameters in society. They have a monopoly on, or pretty much a monopoly on, political powers. Where they've really lost their control, however, is over people's day-to-day lives, as I suggested earlier. They used to assign people to jobs. Now people go out and look for jobs. They used to tell people where they could live. Now people go out and find their own houses or apartments. So the intervention at the personal level has been dramatically reduced over the last three decades. But at the apex, in terms of control of political power, That's still the Chinese Communist Party.
I think, Nick, implicit in Dee's question is sort of the presumption that many of us have, that you can't have thriving capitalism. You can't have an economy that is bubbling along as merrily as the Chinese is and have communism survive, that eventually capitalism leads to democracy.
Well, I certainly think that's the lesson of other countries in East Asia. There are quite a few countries in East Asia that had authoritarian single-party states. And once they had a lot of people in a middle class and people had choices about where they could live and where they were going to travel and other dimensions of their lives, they started to want to have some choice about their political system as well. And many of the states in the region, of course, have made the transition. Think of countries like South Korea or think of Taiwan. They have now moved to democratic systems in which there's voting that elects the head of state. And 20, 30 years ago, these were both, authoritarian single-party states. But the economics, I think, did drive it. Now, when will that happen in China? It's very difficult to say. China is still very poor today compared to where Taiwan and Korea were when they made that transition.
If I asked you to bet a quarter on whether the communists would still be in charge 10 years from now, would you take the bet? And how would you bet?
I would bet they will still be in charge, but it will be a system that has continued to transform. The party's in charge, but there's a lot of accountability today. People can sue the government, for example, in China, which was unheard of in the period when Mao Zedong was running the place back in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s.
They can sue, but do they ever win?
They win. They actually do win in a surprise, not in all cases, certainly, and not even in a majority of cases, but the fact that you can take the government to court and maybe win 30 or 40% of the cases, I think is, most people aren't aware of that. They wouldn't think that the party or the government would allow itself to be put in that position. They've done it, and they've done it voluntarily.
Nick, you have been a tremendous help to us here this afternoon and an even greater help to my colleagues and me in the production of our documentaries. I want to thank you for both very, very much. Nicholas Lardy, Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. One more reminder, our four-part series, The People's Republic of Capitalism, begins tonight at 10 on the Discovery Channel. Coming up, Barack Obama throws a curve at the organizers of the Democratic Convention. Our political junkie, Ken Rudin, is next. It's the talk of the nation on NPR.